yes, there is a time for everything, and now it is time for the Jesus Factor here on the Eagle Radio Network. A lot going on around the world. We're going to have updates on all the news for you, so stand by for that. And good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this edition of the Jesus Factor. Glad you could be here with me today. This, of course, is Scott Stevens. And, you know, there's an awful lot going on in the world here. We've got a series of reports on the different factions operating in the Middle East, some of the things that have not been well covered on much of the national media. Of course, last week we had Stephen Atherton on the Jesus Factor. We interviewed him up at his home base in Vermont. Had a very blessed, invigorating visit with he and his family up to the Vermont ministry from here in beautiful East Hampton, Connecticut, where we have now returned. And of course, the key element of our discussion last week was the idea that the United States has drawn all the wrong lines with regard to when we should enter into a military conflict. We've operated in all the wrong things and provided all the wrong reasons. And we have said for some time here on the Jesus Factor that there is a day of reckoning coming for the United States because of our failure to align ourselves with the Lord. And we may be headed for that in a very short time now. Of course, there are a number of alliances that exist over in the Middle East presently. You have Russia with Assad over there in Syria. You have Korea and China with Iran. And because we have not drawn the line in accordance with the Lord's plan, that line may ultimately turn to our judgment over here in the Middle East. We have spoken many times here on the Jesus Factor of the prophecy that went forth on Ishmael. He will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man. This has defined the operation of the Muslim world from its inception back around 700. And the jihadists that are all over the world, while they be seriously factionalized presently, that means they are divided, not necessarily all believing the same things or all willing to fight for the same situation. When we look at Syria, the question that we have to be left with Mr. Obama rattling the United States military saber, is who should we join ourselves with in the midst of all of this chaos? Who is the enemy over here in the Middle East? And Lord willing, when we come back, we will begin to cover the perspective of, first, of course, Israel, what they're saying about our foray over there. And then we will take a look at the background of the political climate. How did we get here in both Syria and Egypt, the two countries that at present are in a declared state of civil war? You have this kind of violence going on all over the Middle East, but these two countries are the ones that are at the forefront, and of course Syria, the one we are preparing to engage in a military conflict with. So when we come back, we will begin a lengthy analysis of both Syria and Egypt, beginning first with Israel's perspective on our potential military action in the Middle East. So stand by for that here on the Jesus Factor, coming to you on the Eagle Radio Network.
In the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me
Israelites,
sir. Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed.
Oh, me Israelites.
What fun my kids back up and I leave me. Darling, she said I was yours to receive.
Oh, me Israelites.
Shut them a tear up, chose his ago.
That is our Israel Update song. Israel's perspective on all of this, coming from an intelligence source over in Israel, claiming that over the last 24 hours, the United States has indicated that Obama has resolved not just to degrade Syria's chemical capabilities, but also to take down Bashar Assad's air force, destroy his air bases, and knock out his ground-to-ground ballistic missiles using giant B-52 bombers and B-2 stealth bombers. Some of the bombers will fly in directly from the U.S., others from the Al Udeid base in Qatar. F-22 Raptor fighter bombers are also scheduled to take part in the U.S. air offensive. This coming from a intelligence source over in Israel. And certainly Israel concerned about this situation. A little later on in the broadcast, we'll cover the Iranian reaction to the potential for United States intervention in this situation. The United States operation will also target the Syrian Army's 4th and Republican Guard divisions, protectors of the Assad presidency and regime, which were responsible for using the chemical weapons, but not the weapons themselves, according to intelligence sources, which believe that they cannot be destroyed from the air, that only a ground assault will lead to the actual destruction of the weapons, the chemical weapons stockpiles that the Assad regime supposedly has in hand. It was that conclusion which led Washington to considering the airstrikes for taking down the ballistic missiles, which may be used as the vehicles for delivering the poison gases, both within Syria and beyond its borders. This expanded inventory of targets portends a broader operation in scope than Obama's first plan, which was designed only to caution the Syrian ruler of his peril for engaging in chemical warfare. The extensions to this plan would go a lot further than a deterrent warning and seriously downgrade Assad's military and strategic capabilities. Russia and Iran are already getting set up to replenish by air and sea the losses the U.S. air and missile offensive is expected to inflict on the Syrian military. We have, on the Jesus Factor, been speaking for some time of the Russian alliance with President Assad in Syria, and we have for some time pointed to Iran's involvement through various military supports that they have provided the Syrian leader over the past 6 or 7 months. Of course, Iran's stake in all this, perhaps much greater than even Syria's, because we know Iran has been marching toward nuclear sophistication, a place where they would be able to deliver nuclear weapons into this Middle Eastern battlefield. And as we move forward, of course, the Iranian response coming from Reuters news agency in the last 24 hours, according to the Iranian perspective on all of this, the United States will ignite a fire across the Middle East if it attacks Syria. Iran's new foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said on a visit to Iraq on Sunday, warning Western powers against warmongering. Of course, this is the accusation in most of Arab circles that the United States is an imperialist warmongering country, one who exerts its power in a number of unprofitable ways around the world. This, again, going back to our failure to rightly divide this and other battles over the past 50, perhaps 70 years in the United States, particularly our conflict with the Arabs, in which we have allowed this to become a debate over politics and social structure rather than a stark recognition of a hostile enemy's death wish for our ally Israel and for the United States. They have a hostile death wish for both Israel and for the United States. After more than 2 years of civil war, of course, U.S. President Obama is trying to drum up support for limited strikes on Syria in response to the chemical weapons attack that Washington blames on the government of Bashar al-Assad. The Shiite-led government in Baghdad has sought to maintain a neutral stance toward the conflict and opposes any Western military intervention in Syria, fearing it will further destabilize Iraq. "We are concerned about warmongering in this region," said Zarif at a news conference during his first official trip abroad since taking office. "Those who are short-sighted and are beating the drums of war are starting a fire that will burn everyone." We have been saying for nearly 18 months that that fire is already burning. What we as a nation need to do is get ourselves on the Lord's side of the conflict and articulate the battle lines in accordance with His plan and purpose, rather than allowing political and social policy wants and ivory tower pontificators to determine for this nation the appropriate course of action where the Middle East is concerned. Minister Zarif was received by his Iraqi counterpart, Hoshyar Zabari, and was also expected to meet Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki later in the day over there in Iraq. The Syrian conflict has widened a fault between Islam's two main denominations, pitting many Sunni rebels, their Gulf Arab sponsors, and some Western powers against Assad, whose Alawite sect derives from Shiism. Iraq's own sectarian balance has come under acute strain from the civil war next door, which has given new momentum to Sunni Islamist insurgents who have been striking with a frequency and on a scale not seen in years. Sunni and Shiite militants from Iraq have also crossed into Syria to fight on opposite sides of the conflict, complicating the government's official position of neutrality. And this, as we examine this more closely, is the chaotic situation evolving both in Syria and in Egypt and on the Sinai Peninsula, one that is proving to be a meat grinder for those claiming Christ as their Lord in this particular area of the world. Interference in Syria will affect the neighboring countries, maybe directly, including Iraq, which will be affected in terms of security and humanitarian issues, Zabari said at the news conference held there in Iraq. Last week, the Wall Street Journal reported the United States had intercepted a directive from a senior Iranian official instructing Shiite militants in Iraq to attack U.S. interests in Baghdad in the event of a strike. Again, these jihadists come in many shapes and sizes with multiple religious agendas, all of them calling for the extermination of Jews and Christians around the world and the establishment of Islamic regimes first on a national and then on an international basis. The failure of the United States to clearly articulate the danger and nature of this enemy that is coalescing in the Middle East and has hit us in our own homeland vis-a-vis the attack on the World Trade Centers some 10 years ago leaves America in a place where it also is greatly divided as to whether or not this foray into the Middle East makes sense. Because the truth of the matter is the United States will one way or another get dragged into this mess, and it would be far better for us to go in as a people with a clear knowledge of the will of our enemies against us. Al-Ziri Mir Yousefi, the spokesman for Iran's UN mission in New York, this last Saturday denied the allegations of the fomenting of militants, jihadists in Iraq, particularly Baghdad, and said that they were baseless. In other words, the Iranians are not, in fact, involved in fomenting this kind of activity near Baghdad. He said one should remember that reliance on such intelligence reports from anonymous U.S. officials will lead to another disaster similar to the Iraq tragedy. Mir Yousefi was quoted as saying by Press TV once again on Saturday. So you have a number of Arabic leaders chatting, if you will, about how all of this is going to go. And when we come back, we are going to visit one of those family lineages to give people an idea of how people in, particularly in this case, Syria, the Assad family, came to power there. And then we'll take a look a little later in the broadcast at President Morsi over there in Egypt and the factions that supported his presidency. At the same time, we will consider the fate of those who call themselves Christians in these areas, examining how these regimes are presently dealing with them. All of that when we come back to you here on the Jesus Factor on the Eagle Radio Network.
Just take your life.
And that is Nothing Is Easy, an old tune from the band called Jethro Tull, a participant in what was known back then as the British invasion of the United States rock and roll scene. As we look at the situation over in the Middle East, we've been speaking of this for some months and really have had a bit of a problem with the national media, the grand fourth estate here in the United States, and how they have presented this situation. There is information widely available that would clarify all of this for people who are interested. An example of that is information easily found about the Assad family in Syria. Where did they come from? Who are they? The Assad family originates from Suleiman al-Wahish, Hafez Assad's grandfather, who lived in the northern Syrian mountains in the village of Kardaha. The locals reportedly nicknamed him Wahish, which means wild beast in Arabic, because he was physically strong and a good fighter. Al-Wahish remained the family name until the 1920s, when it was changed to Al-Assad, which means lion in Arabic. Because of Suleiman's reported strength and marksmanship, he was respected in his village. At the outbreak of World War I, the Ottoman governor of Aleppo, Valiet, sent troops to the area to collect taxes and round up recruits. The troops reportedly were fought off by Suleiman and his friends, who were only armed with sabers and old muskets. Because Suleiman was respected, he was a local mediator between quarreling families. He was also one of the local chieftains who were the de facto rulers of the area. The chieftains from powerful families would provide protection to their neighbors, and in return, they gained loyalty and respect. This, of course, a typical story of a well-placed Arabic family. This one in Syria, the Assad family, beginning as the Wahish family back in the late 1800s. Many of the prominent people in power over in these Arabic Middle Eastern countries have long histories of tribal leadership and have derived their power, at least as, in part, as a function of their ruthlessness as tribal leaders. This is quite clearly a somewhat watered-down perspective on the elder Assad changing his name to Lion, of course, from Wahish. Hafez al-Assad's father was born in 1875, and he inherited many similar characteristics of his own father and became well respected among the locals. And like many others, he opposed the French occupation. For his accomplishments, he was called El Assad the Lion by the locals. He made his nickname a surname in 1927, and he lived until 1963, long enough to see his sons rise to power. He married twice, and over three decades had 11 children. His first wife, Saida, was from the district of Hefa. They had three sons and two daughters. His second wife was Neasa, 20 years younger than he. She was the daughter of Utman Aboud from the village of Kutiba, a dozen kilometers farther up the mountain. They had a daughter and five sons. Hafez was born on 6 October 1930 and was the fourth child. The al-Assad family has ruled Syria since Hafez al-Assad became president of Syria in 1971. He established an authoritarian regime under the control of the Ba'ath Party. If that political party sounds familiar to you, it should. That, of course, was the party of Saddam Hussein. We will do a more lengthy study of the Ba'ath Party in these Arab nations in another broadcast. The Assads, of course, are originally from Kardaha, just east of Latakia in northwest Syria. They are members of the minority Alawite sect and belong to the Kaliba tribe. And, of course, we spoke of the Alawites here, and we'll get a little bit more clear definition of their perspective on things as we move forward. The family name, Assad, goes back to Ali Suleiman in 1875 to 1963, who, of course, changed his name. The name Al-Assad means the lion, once again, in Arabic. Family connections are presently an important part of Syrian politics. Several close family members of Hafez al-Assad have held positions in the government since his rise to power. In 1971 there. Let's see. He was a statesman, politician, and general who served as the president of Syria from 71 to 2000 and a prime minister from 1970 to 1971. He served as the regional secretary of the regional command of the Syrian regional branch and secretary general of the national command of the Ba'ath Party from 1971 to 2000 and is minister of defense from 1966 to 1972. Born to a poor Alawite family, Assad joined the Syrian wing of the Ba'ath Party in 1946 as a student activist. In 1952, he entered the Homs Military Academy, graduating 3 years later as a pilot. While exiled to Egypt from 1959 to 1961, during Syria's short-lived union with Egypt in the United Arab Republic, Assad and other military officers formed a committee to resurrect the fortunes of the Syrian Ba'ath Party. After the Ba'athists took power in 1963, Assad became commander of the Air Force. In 1966, after taking part in a coup that overthrew the civilian leadership of the party and sent its foundation into exile, he became Minister of Defense. During Assad's ministry, Syria lost the Golan Heights to Israel in the Six-Day War in 1967, dealing Assad a blow that shaped much of his political future. Assad then engaged in a protracted power struggle with Salah Jadid, chief of staff of the armed forces, Assad's political mentor and effective leader of Syria, until finally in November 1970, Assad seized control, arresting Jadid and other members of the government. He became prime minister and in 1971 was elected president. This, of course, the senior al-Assad, the father of the current Syrian leader. And of course, this is a history of violence, ruthlessness, betrayal, conspiracy, everything that is so clearly defined in the prophecy that went forth on Ishmael, his hand will be against every man. He will be a wild man. Very typical of Arabic leaders and how they ultimately rose to power in their various nations. The senior Assad set about building up the Syrian military with Soviet aid. The Soviets were always allies with the Syrians. Now the Russian, the last vestige of the Soviet Union, of course, allied with the former leader, the younger Assad. Political dissenters were eliminated by arrest, torture, and execution. And when the Muslim Brotherhood mounted a rebellion in Hama in 1982, Assad suppressed it. In foreign affairs, Assad tried to establish Syria as a leader of the Arab world. A new alliance with Egypt culminated in the October War against Israel in 1973. But Egypt's unexpected cessation of hostilities exposed Syria to military defeat. In 1976, with Lebanon racked by civil war, Assad dispatched several divisions to that country and secured their permanent presence there as a part of a peacekeeping force sponsored by the Arab League. After Israel's invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon in 1982 through 1985, Assad was able to reassert control of the country, eventually compelling Lebanese Christians to accept constitutional changes, granting Muslims equal representation in government. He aided Palestinian and Lebanese resistance groups based in Lebanon and Syria. Syria joined the U.S.-led alliance against Iraq in the Gulf War from 1990 to 1991. That was the original Gulf War. He sought to establish peaceful relations with Israel in the mid-1990s, but his repeated call for the return of the Golan Heights stalled the talks. This has been a subject of great debate. Even now in the peace talks, so-called, orchestrated by John Kerry with Israel and other nations, particularly the Palestinians over there, the return of these properties that were gained by the lines drawn in the 1967 and 71 wars have been a sticking point of all of these Arab occupiers. His repeated call for the return. Okay, so he died, of a heart attack in 2000 and was succeeded as president by his son, Bashar al-Assad. Bashar Hafez al-Assad, the present leader over there in Syria, is the general secretary of the Ba'ath Party and regional secretary of the party's branch in Syria. He has served as president since 2000, when he succeeded his father, Hafez al-Assad, who had led Syria 30 years prior to his death. So this is a long regime, a long history of a regime of leaders whose power was derived from torture, violence, and wickedness. Al-Assad graduated from the medical school of the University of Damascus in 1988 and started to work as a physician in the army. 4 years later, he attended postgraduate studies in the Western Eye Hospital in London, specializing in ophthalmology. In 1994, after his elder brother Basil, the heir apparent to their father, was killed in a car crash, Bashar was promptly recalled to Syria to take over Basil's role. He entered the military academy and took charge of the Syrian occupation of Lebanon in 1998. In December 2000, Assad married Asma Assad Ni Akhras. Al-Assad was reconfirmed by the national electorate as president of Syria in 2000 and 2007, after the People's Council of Syria had voted to propose the incumbent each time. Initially seen by the domestic and international community as a potential reformer, this expectation ceased when he ordered a mass crackdown and military sieges on pro-rebel protesters amid recent civil war, described by some commentators as related to the wider Arab Spring movement. Of course, this Arab Spring movement is all about the idea that somehow or another one can negotiate with a people who have a long history of hatred and warfare with Israel and the United States. The domestic Syrian opposition, the United States, Canada, the European Union states, and the members of the Arab League have subsequently called for al-Assad's resignation from the presidency. Of course, this latest conflict is defined as one in which al-Assad will be the target. And our problem with this is not only his alliance with Russia, not only his being in league with Iran, not only the support he has gotten from around the world from jihadists. The truth of the matter is many radical Muslims oppose Assad in Syria. And in fact, the factions which we will be aligning ourselves with, should we invade that country, are more clearly understood as being Muslim radicals than this Assad government, which we accuse of the use of chemical weapons against his civilian people. Now, different nations have voted in the UN General Assembly to condemn Assad and the Syrian government over the last several years, and his foreign policy, Al-Assad is an outspoken critic of the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. The Ba'ath Party remains in control of the parliament and is constitutionally the leading party of the state. Until he became president, Bashar al-Assad was not greatly involved in politics. His only public role was the head of the Syrian Computer Society, which introduced the Internet to Syria in 2001. Al-Assad was confirmed as president by an unopposed referendum in 2000. He was expected to take a more liberal approach than his father. In an interview, he stated that he saw democracy in Syria as a tool to a better life, but then argued that it would take time for democracy to come about and that it could not be rushed. Of course, many of these Ba'ath leaders, Saddam Hussein among them, using internal force, military power against their own civilians, who are essentially a factionalized tribalist miasma of varying perspectives, both from a political and religious ideas. They have extraordinarily varied views. And it will only take, in the view of the Jesus factor, sufficient motivation in the form of a hostile enemy invading over there to provoke many of these groups to work together. Politically and economically, Syrian life has changed only slightly since 2000. Immediately after he took office, a reform movement made cautious advances during the Damascus Spring, which led al-Assad to shut down Mezza prison and released hundreds of political prisoners. However, security crackdowns commenced again within the year. By July of 2012, according to analysts, Assad had amassed for himself and his family and associates a fortune of about $1.5 billion, which is held in Russia, Hong Kong, and offshore tax havens to spread the risk of seizure. In a speech about the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict in August of 2006, Bashar al-Assad said that Hezbollah had hoisted the banner of victory, hailing its actions as a successful resistance. He claimed that Arab resistance was growing stronger and warned Israel that, quote, your warplanes, rockets, and your atomic bomb will not protect you in the future. He called Israel an enemy with whom no peace could be achieved as long as they and their allies, especially the United States, support the practice of preemptive war. In the same speech, he also called Arab leaders that have criticized Hezbollah half-men. In April of 2008, Assad told a Qatari newspaper that Syria and Israel had been discussing a peace treaty for a year, with Turkey as a go-between. This was confirmed in May of 2008 by a spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. As well as a peace treaty, the future of the Golan Heights is being discussed. Assad was quoted in The Guardian as telling the Qatari paper, quote, there would be no direct negotiations with Israel until a new U.S. president takes office. The U.S. was the only party qualified to sponsor any direct talks, Assad told the paper, but added that the Bush administration does not have the vision or the will for the peace process. It does not have anything. According to leaked American cables, Bashar al-Assad called Hamas an uninvited guest and said, if you want me to be effective and active, I have to have a relationship with all parties. Hamas is Muslim Brotherhood, but we have to deal with the reality of their presence. Comparing Hamas to the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, which was crushed by his father, Hafez al-Assad, he then claimed Hamas would disappear if peace was brought to the Middle East. Assad has indicated that the peace treaty that he envisions would not be the same kind of peace treaty Israel has with Egypt, where there is a legal border crossing and open trade. In a 2006 interview with Charlie Rose, Assad said, quote, there is a big difference between talking about a peace treaty and peace. A peace treaty is like a permanent ceasefire. There's no war. Maybe you have an embassy, but you actually won't have trade. You won't have normal relations because people will not be sympathetic to this relation as long as they are sympathetic with the Palestinians. 500,000 who live in Syria and 500,000 in Lebanon and another few millions in other Arab countries, once again aligning himself with the Palestinians. During the visit of Pope John Paul II to Syria in 2001, Bashar al-Assad requested an apology to Muslims for the medieval crusades and criticized Israeli treatment of Palestinians, comparing their suffering to that endured by Jesus Christ in Palestine. Assad claimed that followers of Judaism tried to kill the principles of all religions with the same mentality in which they had betrayed Jesus Christ and the same way that they tried to betray and kill the Prophet Muhammad. Responding to claims that his comment was anti-Semitic, Assad said, "Whereas Judaism is a racially heterogeneous religion, the Syrian people are the core of the Semitic race and therefore are opposed to the term anti-Semitism." When offered to retract his comment implying that the Jews were responsible for Jesus' suffering, Assad replied, "As always, there are historical facts that we cannot deny," and stressed that his remarks were not anti-Jewish. Bashar backed an initiative to restore 10 synagogues in Syria, which had a Jewish community numbering 30,000 in 1947, but only 200 Jews today. Since 1972, other parties that accept the leadership role of the Ba'ath Party and support the government's socialist and Arab nationalist orientation have been allowed to operate as members of the National Progressive Front. In 2005, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party was legalized. While some socialist and liberal opposition parties now enjoy a limited degree of toleration, Kurdish and Assyrian parties remain more repressed, and the ban on religious parties is very strictly enforced. During the Syrian uprising, a new parties law established a new constitution, providing the right to create political parties outside the National Progressive Front. Now, I have a list here at the Jesus Factor with some 30-odd political parties. 30. And I can tell you, these are the listed factions that are presently at work in Syria, and the idea that there is something here or someone in that country that we might align ourselves with is simply preposterous. Now, one of the things that we've been hearing a lot about on the news is the hostility towards Christians involved in, taking place in Syria and in Egypt. And just here over the last week, rebels linked to Al-Qaeda seized control of a Syrian Christian village of Malula. And according to an opposition group, as residents fear their historic village has turned into a symbolic, if not strategic, battleground. "God have mercy on Syria," sang the congregation at the Cathedral of Our Lady of Dormition in Damascus this weekend. But miles away, in a historic village nestled on the slopes of the Kalamun Mountains north of the Syrian capital, there was little sign of mercy. The latest reports from Syrian opposition groups said that rebels, including militants from the Al-Qaeda, linked Jabhat al-Nusra. We have spoken of the al-Nusra group here on the Jesus Factor and their operations on the Golan, have gained control of Malula, a Christian village famed for preserving its ancient customs, including Aramaic, the presumed language of Jesus. Declining security and restrictions on the independent media make it difficult to verify reports from the isolated village, but earlier today, accounts came days after Maula residents confirmed that a number of rebel brigades had entered the village on Wednesday. This highlights the fears of the Christian community here in Syria. By Friday, Maula residents told France 24, where this report originates, the rebels had withdrawn from the village, which clings precariously to a dramatic mountain ridge northeast of Damascus. But by Sunday today, fighters from Jabhat al-Nusra, backed by another group, the Kalamun Liberation Front, moved into the Maula after heavy clashes with the army, according to Rameh Abdulrahman of the Lebanon-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Regime forces entered Maula, where snipers were already positioned. They made propaganda videos, which were then broadcast by pro-regime media, explained Abdulrahman in his interview with France 24. In response to this provocation, rebel fighters stormed Maula army troops then left the town and positioned themselves around it. Reporting from Damascus, France 24's Lucy Felder said that while it was difficult to confirm reports that rebels had taken full control of the village, a Syrian government source had reported that there was indeed fierce fighting this morning and that the rebels were led by Jabhat al-Nusra. One more jihadist faction operating here in Syria, and in this case, operating against those who call themselves Christians. More on the Middle East when we come back in just a few moments. Welcome back to the Jesus Factor. Of course, there is no freedom without the Liberator, the Lord Jesus Christ. Even a study of history from a worldly perspective reveals that the ideals of freedom cannot be supported but by the gospel. The United States was, with the exception of Israel to some degree, the first nation to ever propose the idea of individual liberty and have that individual liberty encoded in our founding documents, not because we were smarter than other people, but because the great bulk of Americans during the founding era believed God's word, and he liberated them. Now, as we move on into this, we'll take a brief look at what's going on in Egypt, because Egypt, like Syria, is also in the midst of a war. Take a little stroll while we have a few moments left here through the Morsi regime. Mohamed Morsi is an Egyptian politician who served as the fifth and first democratically elected president in Egypt from the 30th of June 2012 until July 3rd, 2013. He is considered by most to be the first democratically elected head of state in Egyptian history, although his predecessors also held elections, which were generally marred by irregularities and allegations of rigging. Once again, not unlike Assad. He was, however, the first president to have first assumed his duty after an election, as opposed to his predecessors who came into power as revolutionaries. These include Nasser, way back in the 60s and 70s, and appointed successors Sadat and Mubarak. And Mohamed Morsi was educated in Egyptian public schools and universities. He was later granted a scholarship from the Egyptian government to prepare for a PhD degree in the United States. Morsi was a member of parliament in the People's Assembly of Egypt from 2000 to 2005 and a leading member in the Muslim Brotherhood. He became chairman of the Freedom and Justice Party, the FJP, when it was founded by the Muslim Brotherhood in the wake of the 2011 Egyptian Revolution. He stood as the FJP's candidate for the May 2012 presidential election. The Election Commission announced that Morsi had won on the 24th of June in 2012, thus becoming the first democratically elected president. In his runoff against Ahmed Shafiq, deposed leader Hosni Mubarak's last prime minister, according to the official results, Morsi took about 51.7% of the vote and Shafiq received 48.3%. As he had promised during his campaign, Morsi resigned from his position as the head of the FJP after the victory was announced. After Morsi temporarily granted himself unlimited powers to protect the nation from the Mubarak-era power structure, which remained in place in late November of 2012, and the power to legislate without judicial oversight or review of his acts, hundreds of thousands of protesters began demonstrating against him in the 2012 Egyptian protests. On 8 December of 2012, Morsi annulled his decree, which had both expanded his presidential authority and removed judicial review of his decrees, an Islamist official said, but added that the effects of that declaration would stand. So all the things that took place in that time period that Morsi had established essentially as an elected dictator were not removed. On June 30th of 2013, mass protests erupted across Egypt calling for the president's resignation following severe fuel shortages and electricity outages, which evidence suggests were orchestrated by Mubarak-era Egyptian elites with the intention of causing a coup, very common among left-leaning revolutionaries. Find a way to disrupt the workings of society and blame those that are in power. You have begin to get an idea through our report on the Syrian leadership and this beginning report on Morsi as to how things are done in these nations and why the kind of chaos that existed that was so clearly prophesied in the Word of God about the children of Ishmael, why this chaotic operation continues, why there is factionalization and why there is violence and war among a people who do not know the gospel. Quite clearly, these are people whose only faith is in worldly power. Whether or not they believe the fantasies about Muhammad the prophet and the Muslim doctrine, they cleave to worldly power and will do anything to hold on to it. It was followed, of course, that the protests erupted and then were followed by the army's threat that if the protesters' demands were not met, that it would remove the democratically elected government, including Morsi, and build a roadmap for the country, while insisting that it did not want to rule the country. Some took this to mean a military coup, but the next day, the army denied that they were referring to a possible military coup. The plan set up by the military includes suspending the constitution, dissolving the parliament, and establishing a new administration headed by the chief justice. Morsi was declared unseated on the 3rd of July of 2013 by a council consisting of the defense minister Abdul Fattah al-Sisi, opposition leader Mohammed el-Baradei, the Grand Imam of Al-Jahar, Ahmed el-Tayyib, and the Coptic Pope, Tewodros II. On the 1st of September 2013, prosecutors referred Morsi on charges of inciting deadly violence. No date has been set and he went since he was elected to Parliament in 2000. All right, so they have referred him for trial, and he's made several controversial comments over the years about the September 11th attacks that have drawn criticism in the United States, including stating that it is insulting to suggest that damage from an aircraft collision brought down the World Trade Center. There are people who believe that that is not what happened. He is not the only one. All right, and now political faction in Egypt, much like what you have in Syria. All right, and this is really the problem with the multiple factions there. You have extraordinary chaos, and as we move forward in our continuing reporting on the Middle East, we will create and paint for you a clearer picture of that country and how it plays into God's plan as it unfolds in these times of the church, perhaps drawing to an end as conflict in the Middle East begins to unfold. We thank you all for listening to the Jesus Factor here on the Eagle Radio Network. May God bless you. And do join us again next week for another broadcast of the Jesus Factor.